I'd like to introduce a friend of mine and our main speaker for the evening, Tom Inn from Alpine.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom Navarez. I'd like to thank you for having me here tonight. It's an honor to speak at the best Saturday night speakers meeting I know of. I'd like to welcome the newcomers that introduced themselves and the ones that didn't. The guys that introduced themselves, I've happened to have known both of them for a long time. I'm glad you're both here. I bounced in and out for a long time myself, you know, and it was no fun. Trying to make that lie the truth, you know, and just doesn't fit. My sobriety date is January 3rd of 1989. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened before that, and why that's my sobriety date, and what I'm like today. You know, it's always a trip talking like this because I only have one story, and I all of a sudden become unconscious and draw a blank before I'm gonna tell my story. I only have one story, you know. So here we go. When I was a little kid, I lived in L.A., and, you know, my family was very caring family. I remember being a really nervous kid. I used to pull my eyelashes out, and I remember my little sister used to have a bald spot on the top of her head. She pulled her hair out. There was a lot of stuff going on in my house that I didn't know about until later on, and it explained a lot, you know, the tension that was there and the nervousness and the unease. But, you know, my parents, on the outside, everything looked awesome. You know, I went to a school where I wore a white shirt and a little bow tie and salt and pepper pants and shiny shoes, and went to Mass a couple times a week. And I remember I was about eight. And I had this neighbor across the street, and I loved this guy because he had tattoos, and he slicked his hair back, and he had pictures of naked women in his garage that was full of motorcycles, and he was my idol, you know? I knew I was really him, but I was trapped in these salt and pepper pants, and I couldn't get out, you know? And He sat me up on his mailbox one day. I think I was about eight, and that's the time that we lived in that area. And he shared a Coors with me. And I drank Coors until January 2nd of 1989. You know, that was the first time I remember drinking anything. How I remember my dad growing up is he was a really angry guy, violent and angry. He was an engineer, and he was always studying. He's got a bunch of degrees, and he was always trying to get another degree. And how I remember my dad is seeing his back and him sitting at his desk, and you really didn't want to bug him. We had moved to Marina Del Rey, and we had this huge house, and downstairs was a bar. And there was my parents were having a party, which they didn't do very often. And it was mostly relatives, you know. And there was a bottle of Wild Turkey got dropped on the counter, and it broke. And my dad, who really didn't drink, was up on the bar on all fours, lapping up this whiskey off the bar, and everybody was laughing at him. And he was having a good time. And I'd never seen him have a good time. So I associated the release from being as uptight as he was with Wild Turkey. And So the next day, I took a couple Pall Malls out of my mom's purse and poured myself a big glass of Wild Turkey. I wanted some release myself, you know. And I got real sick. And that wasn't a real good experience for me. We moved to San Diego. And when we moved down here, I was the last three months of sixth grade. And I got to go to a public school. And that's why I'm alcoholic. I'd always been in a Catholic school, and I was trapped, and I really knew I was Ray Emler. And I was trapped in those salt and pepper pants, and I was born in 1960, so this is 1971. And that was a good time to start getting loaded, you know? I mean, I got to wear... The pants that I traded for my salt and pepper pants were bell-bottom striped pants and a paisley shirt, you know? I was kind of bummed. I was, you know, in hindsight, after doing some writing, I was resentful that I had missed being a hippie. You know, I mean, I had just missed it, and I was trying to catch up. So I started drinking alcoholically when I was between, you know, 12 and 13. And by that, I mean, we were all the people that I was growing up with. We all smoked pot. We all stole booze from our parents' liquor cabinets, and we'd go down to the beach and get people to buy for us, and drinking alcoholically young. My heroes immediately went from Bart Starr and Johnny Unitas to Mick Jagger and Jimi Hendrix. And I really idolized those guys, you know. And it was such an immediate transformation. So anyway, I drank hard and drugged hard for a long time, you know, and really fast. You know, by the time I was 15, I was a basket case, you know. I took a test to, school was just in the way. I took a proficiency test that was the equivalent of a diploma if you passed it and you could get out. And I had moved out when I was 15, and I had passed this test. And I started shoveling concrete when I was 16. And I've been doing that for 31 years. I moved back home a bunch of times. You know, that's what tough guys do. They go back to mom's house. But when I started working in construction, we were making a lot of money, you know, because... minimum wage at that time was $1.75 an hour. And I remember we were making $2 cash. Cash. And that was a lot of money. You know, you could buy a quart of Eastside for 55 cents and get a nickel back on the bottle. A five-finger lid cost $10. I mean, what else do you need? You know, you're making $16 a day. Think about it. Another thing that was different, damn, it's hot up here. Another thing that was different was, you know, back then I hitchhiked everywhere. You know, if my kids did half the stuff I did, they'd be black and blue. I mean, it's just, I remember I was 13 and me and my brother were hitchhiking back up to L.A., you know, after we moved here. And it was no big deal. It was just the way it was. So, great music in those years. A lot of good Stone stuff. I love the Stones. A lot of good everything. Like Bill Wilson talked about, you know, having both drink and sedative. I did a lot of both of those. My primary purpose is alcoholism. You know, I would like to think that every breath I take has to do with my recovery and contributing to somebody else's. Recovery from alcoholism is my life. It's my kid's life. It's my parents' life. It threads into all their lives because my alcoholism threaded into their lives. And I cannot thank God enough for bringing me to you people. So, I'm Hispanic, so I thought I should be getting married a lot, or be getting married once is how it started, but I got married the first time when I was 19, and she was 18. By then, I had picked, you know, I was a total, absolute hope to die drunk. The book talks about we were seldom mildly intoxicated. I mean, young, you know, moved out and living with my friends and couch surfing and all that stuff. Other drunks would say, man, you are just blasted all the time. And I was. And I'm in a trade where showing up with a case of beer at 5:30 in the morning, if you don't, you don't work every day. You know, the guys that always bring beer every day are the guys at work. And so it was a very accepted thing in my trade. And so by the time I was 19, I was a mess. I had lost so much of myself, I didn't even know it, you know. I was completely unaware. And I got married to this gal who was totally straight. She was a cheerleader at San Diego State, and she was a retail clerk at Vons, and her dad was the head of the engineering department of San Diego, of City of San Diego, and the vice president of the Carpenters Union, and he had a bunch of oil wells, and she was for me. And God, I drug her through hell. I just drug her through hell. We were married for a couple of years, and then I had, while I was married to her, I found somebody who was just like me. You know, I thought that marrying somebody that wasn't like me would change me. And it didn't. I just brought her into my tornado. And her parents. And her family. You know. And I know you know. So I got married again to this other gal. And so now I'm 22, been married twice. And her and I had a son, Michael. And in that time, I had dabbled in the import-export business, which I'm really bad at. It's hard to sell anything when there's no product left all the time. And anyway, I left. I had left that marriage. As a kid, and then, if you want to call it adulthood, I was in and out of jail a lot for just really stupid stuff. You know, not showing up for tickets. And anyway, I had left my second wife. And a week before my son's first birthday. And I don't know how, but I got this. In the time when I was married to this straight gal, I went to community college, and I took a prep course for the state surveyor's license, and I took a couple drawing classes, and I learned. I never finished any of them. I just went long enough to learn all the buzzwords, and I lied my way into every job I've ever had. Right after I left my second wife, I ended up getting this job making just an ungodly amount of money. And excuse me. And in the next 11 months, I got 3 502s. You know, being an alcoholic, my definition of an alcoholic at that time was no big deal. I mean, we'd sit around and slap each other on the back and say, I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, me too. I'll buy this round. You buy the next one. You know, and it's just, so what? But when I got sober, for me, it was a profound difference between saying I was an alcoholic and being powerless over alcohol. For me, were two entirely different things. I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. My wives didn't know I was powerless over alcohol. Maybe they did, I don't know, but I didn't. I sure wasn't admitting it. So I started going to AA to try to stay out of jail. And I bounced in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. And in that 5 years, I could never get 30 days. As a matter of fact, from the time I was 13 until I was 28 when I got sober, I don't think I was ever sober for 30 days unless I was in jail. I started coming to AA. And I went to a lot of meetings where I didn't introduce myself. I went to a lot of meetings loaded. You know, when we sing happy birthday, then we have all these little cute things we say afterwards, you know. All that I ever say is keep coming back. Because that's all they ever told me. They didn't say without a drink. They didn't say to call my sponsor. They said to keep coming back. And thank God for that. Thank God for that. Because I wouldn't be here today. So in that time of bouncing in and out, I was living in Lakeside. I moved a lot, you know, because if I move to the hills, that'll help. If I move back to the beach, that'll help. If I marry the straight one, that'll help. Everything and more about alcoholism. I'll only drink beer. I'll only drink on the weekends. I'll only drink wine. I'll only shoot heroin. I remember, it was shooting gallery night at my house, and I was on one of these binges where I wasn't going to drink, and somebody offered me a beer. I said, no, I'm not drinking tonight. Hold me off, would you? You know? And it made sense. It made sense. And I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol. And I tried everything I knew 1,000 times over to prove that I wasn't powerless over alcohol. Because all those Monday mornings when I'd wake up with an empty wallet and a hellacious hangover, and I always felt guilty about that. I always felt bad about it. Anyway, so I'm going to meetings, and I remember I was at a meeting at the El Cajon Alano Club before it burnt down many moons ago. And they were going to have a potluck. And I'm thinking, man, I am really going to give this thing a try. And people would suggest that I get involved. So this was like on a Tuesday, and the potluck was on a Friday, and I thought about it all week, you know. And I came home early from work, and I cooked the only thing that I could really cook good at that time, which was a pot of beans. And I took my pot of beans to this potluck. Everybody loved my beans. And I was really felt a part of. And I had gotten up enough nerve to ask somebody to be my sponsor. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and I swear to you, what he said to me was that I was going to have to perform oral sex on him every day for the rest of my life if I wanted to stay sober. And of course I said, F no. I know today what he asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths. And I wasn't. And he told me I wasn't ready. So 2 nights later, I'm laying on the floor of the Silver Spigot because I had fallen off my bar stool. And the bartender, who was a girl I was drinking with the night before, was standing over me with that look, you know, shaking her head. And she says, you need to go back to AA. I said, I was just there and they told me I wasn't ready. So, oh, God. Right about when Larry was getting sober was, Larry got sober 112288. I was really trying to get sober. I mean, I had been in and out of AA and gotten little bits and pieces of it. I was really getting tired of me. And I was really trying to make a run at it. And just, I couldn't do it. And, I started my last run on Christmas, and you know, my sobriety date is January 3rd. And in that time, there was a lot that happened. You know, it didn't look any different. It looked the same. Same wrecked house. You know, when I party like that, when I'm really having fun, I hallucinate and I pick at myself. I see things underneath my skin, and they got to get out. And I don't eat, and I drink Coors and smoke Marlboros and do other stuff that keeps you up, and that's all I do. That's all I do when I'm having fun. The fun was over a long time ago, man. I was in a prison that I had built the walls myself. And I had no idea. You know? And what had happened at the end of my last run was, you know, I went to bed, and by this time, everywhere I could reach on my body was a scab. There was this huge rat in the corner of my room, and I couldn't move. I couldn't move. I could barely blink in bed. And I watched this rat all night, and he watched me all night. And as the sun was coming up, I saw it was a pair of socks in the corner of my room. And it was a Monday morning. And, you know, the only thing that was different, it was like 1,000 other Monday mornings, you know. Armful of holes, empty wallet, wrecked house, spent the rent, never saw my kid for Christmas. All the same stuff that I had felt guilty about before. The only thing that was different is I didn't feel guilty. I got up and I looked in the mirror. And there was none of me there. And I said, I'm going to die like this, and I don't care. I'm going to die like this, and I don't care. And when I heard myself say that, it scared me. Because I had surrendered to alcohol. I had surrendered to alcohol. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know that's what I was doing. But that's what I was doing. You win. Everything I've tried doesn't work. AA doesn't work. Drinking beer only doesn't. None of this stuff I've tried works. I'm going to die like this. And there was a guy who's been my best friend since I was 13. And he had been sober for 6 months. I heard he'd been sober for 6 months. And I called him. And he came over that day and gave me the most precious thing that any of us can give each other. He gave me his time. He didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. He just knew that's what he was supposed to do. And he came over and spent the day with me. He came over and helped me put that train set together that I was supposed to give my son for Christmas. My son lived across the street with his mom. God, I got cotton mouth, man. What are you doing on that computer over there? Yeah, I thought so. Before I called him, and I was looking at myself, and I had truly accepted dying with alcoholism and being okay with it. Something snapped in me. And there was a little sunny spot. I had this little tiny apartment on Marina Boulevard, and there was a little sunny spot that came through the kitchen window by my dining room table. And I went and knelt down in that spot and called my friend. You know, I asked God, I said, "Man, if you're out there, help me. I can't stand another second of myself." And it was a God I was scared of. You know, I went to confession a lot, and I was, you know, I knew God could see in the dark. When I was a kid, I should end up in a burn center, I'll tell you. But anyway, it was not a loving God. And for me to ask that God for help and for me to be willing to do that took me not being able to stand another second of myself. And I'll tell you, man, when I called him, wasn't necessarily because I wanted to stop drinking. It was because I didn't want to live how I was living anymore. You know, at that point in my life, there was nobody in my life whose life was better because I was in it. Nobody. So I was too ripped up, too physically ripped up to go to a meeting that night. So I called my sobriety date January 3rd, which was a Tuesday night. I went to the Tuesday night step study in LA Gardens, which is still there. And hooked up with a bunch of guys that were really into AA. And they drug me to meetings every night. And, basically, I mean, not literally, but basically, for the first 3 years I was sober, I went to a meeting every day and had commitments to all of them. That's how they were, and that's what I was taught. You know, they would say, like, wear a tie anytime you're behind a podium, taking a cake or giving a cake. I'm like, why? And they're like, "Do you want a drink?" I'm like, "No." I was, okay, I'll do it. You know, everything was, "Do you want a drink?" It was all about change. You know, I had no respect for anyone or anything. I was always the class clown. And they explained to me that those days were over. And I didn't know it, but, you know, the first commitment I had was standing at the door shaking hands at Old Town Speakers meeting when I was 5 days sober. I still do that commitment now. You hear a lot of stuff in AA that's funny. And one of them is the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over, expecting different results. You know, the definition of insanity to me is stop doing what works. What I did in the beginning still works today. And I would be crazy to stop doing that. So they were all real involved with young people's. They were all in the young people's committee because we were all young. It was more of a dating service for me than anything. Although those commitments kept me sober. You know, it's a program of attraction. I had been sober for a little over a month. I had a truck that was registered to me. It had insurance in my name. I had a driver's license. And for those things to all happen at once had been a long time. I had an old girlfriend call me, and she wanted me to come and get her and spend the weekend with her because her boyfriend was going out of town. So I drove out. I was living in Bay Park at the time. I drove out to Santee, and I went to go pick her up. And I hear music inside the house. I knock on the door, and she didn't answer. And there wasn't. So I went to the corner gas station to, you know, put a quarter in the payphone. This was prior to cell phones. And I call her and she didn't answer. I went back to the door and knocked on the door again, and I went back to the phone and called again, went back to the door and knocked again. She wouldn't answer the door, and I was really looking forward to it. She used to roller skate around my living room in little Bo Peep costumes and stuff. It was awesome. Anyway, it's really hot up here now. I was driving down Mission Gorge, and I was saying out loud, driving my truck, I said, God, thank you so much for letting me see what it's like to be sober for 30 days. Thank you so much for letting me have this truck. Thank you so much for everything you've given me, but I'm going to drink. And I pulled into the parking lot of my favorite topless bar, and it had burnt down the weekend before. And I just had to put my hands up in the air. I said, all right, man, you win. And that was truly the last time that I've had a desire to drink. I'm not saying that God came down and slapped a drink out of my hand. And I'm not saying that's what has to happen to anybody else, but that's what happened to me. So I'm going, you know, experiencing AA. And right after that, I had a gal who I had brought home from the Silver Spigot like in August of 88. I didn't know her. She stayed at my house for a couple days, and that was it. And she called me. And she said, do you remember me? I said, yeah, I remember you. And she says, you know, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm not drinking anymore. You know, I can't party with you. And she goes, well, I'm going to church. I found God there. And so, you know, and she came over that night and spent the night. And nine months and 6 minutes later, she had a baby that she was saying was mine. And, you know, by the time Hannah was born, I'm still less than a year sober. I didn't know what was going on. I was making good money. I thought she was daddy hunting. I ditched her for a couple of years, as long as I could. You know, blaming her. She's hunting me down. That kid's not mine. Finally, I had a sponsor that made me go get a paternity test and found out she was mine. So I started taking her. She was about a year and 9 months old. And I would take her to the park for an hour, go pick her up and spend a little time with her here and there. Which was scary for me. I didn't know. I remember driving down the road with my son Michael, who was 5 when I got sober. He's like 7 now. We're driving down the road in my truck. And I said, Michael, you might have a sister and she might be coming to live with us. And I don't know how to be a dad to a girl. And he scooted over on a seat and put his arm around me. He says, we can do it, Dad. And we did. You know, I went to go see her. I went to go see Hannah on her second birthday. It was the day of her second birthday. And it was an especially hot day for November. And she had stuff coming out of her diapers, and she had a sweater that used to be white that was filthy black, and her mom had tracks up and down her arms. By this time, she'd started prostituting, and she was a mess. And there was no toys and no food, no diapers. And she told me that that two men had come into her apartment that night, and one of them took her in the bathroom and raped her, and the other one had Anna out in the living room, and she doesn't know what happened to her. And I said, I didn't want to. I did not take her because I'm a virtuous man. I took her because I had to. And besides my sobriety, my kids are the biggest gift in my life. You know, Hannah's lived with me since her second birthday. And Shalane was there that day. She was waiting out in the truck, and I came out with Hannah, and I said, she's going to live with me now. I took her home, gave her a bath, and went and bought her some clothes and some toys, and took her to the doctor the next day. She was all right. Nothing had happened to her. And anyway, I got married again and again and again and again in sobriety. I had two more boys with my second wife. So I got Michael and Hannah and Luke and Jake. Those kids have been through a lot. You know, even though three of my children have never seen me drink, they've gotten to experience my alcoholism. You know, I've been sober for 19 years. My sponsor, his name is Bob. He's been sober for 29. His sponsor's name is Clancy. He's been sober for 49. And that just tells me that time in Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't mean much. All that it means is that I've had a lot of opportunity to make a lot of mistakes. You know, another thing that I hear around here is that the quality of our problems changes. And what's changed for me is the quality of my solutions. Of our solutions. You know, I think the beginning of that spiritual experience that it talks about for me was saying that I can't do this. I can't do it. Because I tried and tried and tried and tried. When I had surrendered to alcohol, what I was saying is that I can't do it. But what I found here is that we can't. I can't do this without you. My son Michael, who was 5 when I got sober, is now in the Air Force. He's just finishing up a year of being in linguist school learning Russian. Me and my other kids, who all live with me, are going to watch him graduate along with my dad, who I hated. Go watch him graduate on the 8th. And I can't believe it, you know. My daughter, who, her mom was doing a lot of drugs when she was a baby, and she was diagnosed as a drug baby and has had learning disabilities. Nowadays when you graduate high school, you have to pass an exit exam. And you have to give the speech and you have to do community service to get out of high school in California. And there was no way she was going to pass that exit exam. And she called me on Wednesday and told me that she'd passed. You know, stuff happens in my life that's unbelievable. You know, absolutely unbelievable. I get to take a lot of guys through the steps. And it wasn't always like that. You know, there was a period of time when I was married to my wife, and when I got married in sobriety the first time, that I had Luke and Jake with. And, you know, my business, I got a license and I started a business, and my business went through the roof. And I was making a lot of money. And I'm 10 years sober and I'm driving around getting speeding tickets, jumping out of the truck, yelling at everybody. You know? I made $389,000 that year, but I was a mess. My wife spent $90,000 in the casino that year and left me, which was tough. And that experience really, really, really taught me the difference between the price of things and the value of things. And that's what it took, you know. I had 35 employees at that time. I got rid of everybody. I went down to 12 guys and just started doing less and spending more time with my kids. I got a new sponsor and really, really, really found out what was in the book. And stuff that was huge deals in my first 4-step I talk about from the podium, you know. and my first four-step, the gnarliest thing was my one and only prostitute experience ended up being a guy. He had on a brown skirt, and I swear, to this day, I still swear he had the nicest ass in the bar, but it turned out to be a guy. And I was going to my grave with that, you know? And what came out at 11 years was that my overall low opinion of women came from my perception of what my mom was doing. You know? In the third step, it talks about, take away my difficulties, that victory over them will bear witness to those I could help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. My difficulties are my perceptions, because I had always had them confused with the circumstances in my life. But the same, I still have relationship problems. I still have money problems. What's changed is my perceptions of those things. And I would have never known that. So anyway, listen, thank you very much for having me here tonight. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids owe their lives to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much for having me.